At the top of a ridge we stopped to take in the picturesque surroundings. After crossing over into Colorado, it was no time at all before Carrie, who was navigating, directed me to the turn off for Mesa Verde. We turned onto the steep, winding road leading to the cliff dwellings. As we crept up the side of the mountain, we noticed it looked rather ominous. The trees were all dead black and withered, standing like statues. Under the trees the new growth stood only a few feet high. In some areas it was like looking into an ocean of purple wild thistle. It was beautiful and at the same time dark in its appearance. Later that day we were told there had been a forest fire there a few years prior. Fortunately the fire didn't make its way to the ancient cliff dwelling sites. After reaching the top of the mountain we found a parking spot at the main tourist center. It was midday so the sun was at its peak. We walked across the street to the tourist office to book a tour of one of the ancient sites. Our trip was on such a tight schedule that we went straight for the booking desk. We found a short tour that suited our time constraints, bought tickets and grabbed a map. We were told that after the tour we would be able to visit another site where we would be free to walk around on our own. Our guide took us on a short walk around one of the cliff dwelling sites. The red rock clay had been made into bricks to build the walls of the dwellings. It was an amazing privilege to stand so close to these buildings. As I touched the wall I wondered who had lived there, why they left and what their lives were like. I could feel the presence of the people who had lived there so long ago. Closing my eyes for a moment, I listened to the wind and tried to picture the faces of the people walking about the dwelling. The guy then took us over to the kiva. She explained that this had been a place where earth ceremonies were held by the people who had once lived there. Although the people were long gone, I still somehow felt we were intruding in the private homes of people that had not invited us. When the tour was over, we decided to check out the free tour site at Spruce Tree Palace, another spectacularly large cliff dwelling site. When we arrived, we followed the other tourists on the footpath towards the site. We took a few pictures along the first part of the trail, then Carrie walked on ahead of me. She disappeared around the corner as the trail curved around in a U-shape. It was getting hotter and even in the shade the heat's effects were overwhelming. The tree's shade was cooling, so I took my time catching up to her. I meandered around the corner of the trail. My head hung low from the overwhelming heat. As the trail curved around I lifted my head and looked up the slight hill where I saw a Native American man with short black hair looking at the cliff dwelling with another person. Oh my God, it's Harold. I shook my head and blinked. Okay Miriam, it can't be him, it just can't. You're crazy and this is just going too far. A million thoughts flashed through my mind all at once. What should I do? I felt like fainting and screaming at the same time. After I caught up with Carrie I briefly told her the story of Harold and the alien connection. In 1988 the aliens told me that one day I would meet a Native American man on top of a mountain. He would have short black hair and his name would be Harold. I would recognize him when I saw him. Apparently he would approach me when we met and he would teach me a great deal. I was in shock that the man I just laid eyes on could possibly be the man I had been waiting to meet for many years. I wondered how I could confirm it was him. How can I find out his name? I thought. And then I remembered that, if it indeed was him, he would approach me. Carrie and I walked around the site, but I was completely distracted as my mind reeled from the possibility of meeting Harold. Carrie kept telling me to go and talk to him, but I felt I had to wait for him to approach me. We began walking back to the car on the trail, and I waited to see if the man would approach me. When we were about 20 feet away from him, I noticed he looked at his companion and then began walking towards us. My breath felt like it stopped, my heart quickened and I swallowed hard. Hashes could be a defining moment in my life, I thought as I felt the energy of it. I didn't look back. What if it is Harold? What would it all mean? Why was I led to him? Why was I drawn to taking this trip to Mesa Verde? Why did the aliens tell me about him? I heard quick steps behind me and as I looked to my left there he was, walking alongside me. Hello, he said. I beamed and thought, my God, it must be him. We began a conversation about the ancient site Carrie and I had just visited. He then told me his name, Harold. I felt like breaking into tears, but I knew that I had to stay composed. I couldn't fathom what it all meant. What, if anything, lay in the future for the two of us? I wondered. As we walked the trail heading back to our cars, Harold pointed to a side trail where we could look at an example of poison ivy. Neither Carrie nor I knew what it looked like, so we veered off to have a look. The trail was only about 25 feet long. We all stood together at the end of the trail listening, while Harold showed us the leaves of ivy. He then began asking about our trip, where had we been and where were we going. We gave them a brief overview of our travel plans, then told Harold and his friend that we were impressed to see the Navajo people still had very strong cultural roots. One of the most wonderful aspects of the trip was our introduction and exposure to the people and their culture. Harold then told us a story about the wind in his native language. As I listened to him, the most amazing image came to me. While looking into his eyes, I saw spirals going back into them as far as I could see. They were never ending. In that millisecond, there was a flash, like a cover being raised from over his face. He no longer looked human. It was indescribable. It was so strange and fast that I barely had time to acknowledge the whole experience. My vision reverted back to normal as quickly as it had left. I was then more intrigued by my meeting with Harold than ever. After such an overload of emotions, my mind was blank as we all walked the trail back towards the parking lot. When we reached the tourist office, Harold and his friend gave us some advice on where to camp in Monument Valley. We said goodbye and Carrie and I headed back to our car. The farewell seemed too normal for such an abnormal afternoon. As the two of us walked on the sidewalk together, I let my emotions run free as I cried and told Carrie details of what I just experienced. Carrie thought I should tell Harold the story, but I could barely think clearly, let alone collect my thoughts enough to tell him. There was no way I could explain a lifetime story of alien contact to this man in only a couple of minutes. Questions were swirling through my thoughts as I wondered what our encounter meant. And this was a significant moment in my life, and I needed time to assimilate what had happened and contemplate why it had happened. "Miriam, he's coming," said Carrie as we stood at the trunk of our car. Harold and his friend quickly caught up to us and asked if we wanted to go with them back to Cortez and hang out. I really wanted to go, but, sadly, Carrie wasn't interested. She kept saying that we wouldn't have enough time to cover our planned areas of interest if we took a detour. After a short conversation with the men, we exchanged email addresses and they left. The two of them walked away, got into a silver Jeep, and drove off. Hashes was all amazing, but what does it mean? I thought. I shook with energy as I tried to hold back how much this meeting had affected me. As we backed out of our parking spot, I had a feeling we would see them again part way down the mountain. Sure enough, they were there, parked on the side of the road. We waved as we passed them. Why was I tuning into this man? I often had this happen with close friends, but not with complete strangers. It only solidified my confirmation that we were indeed meant to meet. Shortly after we left, we realized we didn't know what route to take to Monument Valley. We pulled over at the next available rest area and looked over the map. There was only enough room for one car at the edge of the mountain. A moment later, we saw the guys again. And this time they waved and passed us. After we were on our way again, we noticed a vehicle that looked like Harold's pull into a parking lot at the bottom of the mountain. We weren't sure who it was, so we just kept going. When we didn't stop, the vehicle kept driving straight through the parking lot and back onto the road. It followed directly behind us. We realized it was the two of them, so we stopped with our windows down. Harold pulled up and asked one more time if we wanted to go with them. We told them we couldn't, all the while wishing we could. I had to respect Carrie's wishes, however. I told him he would definitely be hearing from me, and then we drove off. And at night we camped in Monument Valley at Goulding's campground, an amazing sight with red rock reaching towards the heavens. When we woke, we realized the full beauty of the area. It was spectacular to watch the sunrise spill over the rock, changing its color as each second passed. Our next stop was Kinyandachelli. The red rock mesas along the drive were spectacular. The sun's rays made the rust colors of the rock come alive before our eyes. The dry, stark desert changed in an instant. Each moment, the sun's rays changed the color of the red rock from light pink to rich rust red. If you were to sit and look at one area of red rock all day, it would forever change color with the direction of the sun. Each hour brings to life a completely new view. Kinyandachelli is on Navajo Reserve land. The Navajo own a canyon land even though it is a national park. They still live on the canyon floor, herding sheep, planting corn and leading a more traditional life. From the overlook sites you could see corn growing and sheep grazing. Although it appeared to be a hard life, it looked like the way life should be lived, in harmony with the land, not against it. They hold the land as sacred. From the moment we arrived at the canyon, we were swept away by its beauty. It took no time for us to find out there was a campground at the top of the canyon. Shortly after we arrived, the owner of the campground, Stevenson, came by to say hello. He was a very friendly Navajo man. And rough our conversation, we learned that he could take us on a guided tour around Spider Rock, one of the lookout points on the canyon floor. And is thrilled, Carrie and I, as we would have a very personal tour of a sacred place. Everything was perfect and I finally felt like I could relax a little. There was still plenty of time in the day to take in the sights at the top of the canyon, since the hike to the floor wouldn't begin until morning. We viewed the bottom of the canyon from designated overlook sites on the canyon rim. Words couldn't capture the amazing life of the canyon floor. The life in the canyon captivated us, not only as it appeared in the present, but also as it had once been in the past. We couldn't understand why there weren't more tourists, because it was one of the most interesting and breathtaking sights we had seen on our trip so far. We were both thankful it still had its innocence. We watched the sunset at one of the lookout points, and said goodnight to the spirit of the canyon. 7 a.m. came early as Carrie and I headed out with Stevenson and one other camper to hike to the canyon floor. We took lots of water with us. I was having trouble with the heat, so Stevenson told me to walk slowly and I would be fine. He took us down the side of the canyon towards Spider Rock. The wind whispered to us as we walked, and Stevenson recounted stories of his people. Along the way, he showed us small cliff dwellings and broken pottery shards. We didn't disturb anything out of respect and were grateful to Stevenson for sharing it all with us. The heat was exhausting and I felt as though I wouldn't be able to hike back to camp. Luckily, there was a creek that ran along the canyon floor, hidden by trees on both sides. We took a short break by lying in the cool water. Everyone laughed at me as I enjoyed the cool water running over my whole body. As I lay there, splashing the water on myself, I took a moment to step back in time. How many before me found this refuge in the waters of the past? I felt honored to make a personal connection with the canyon floor. After hours of hiking, we made our way back to the campsite. I took in every moment of our walk, the cool water of the creek, the red rock on the canyon walls, and the green grass that covered the canyon floor. When we finally arrived back at camp, Stevenson graciously invited us to have dinner with him. We accepted his offer and drove into Chinle to a restaurant. After our long hike and days of only camp food, the relaxation of being served dinner was wonderful. When we got back from Chinle, we saw a vehicle pull into the campground and choose a spot two sites over from us. We watched as they set up their tent and settled in. As usual, Stevenson made his way over to the couple to chat with them for a few minutes. After Stevenson left, the couple walked over to our campsite to say hello and introduced themselves as Barbara and Zach. Our conversation consisted of the usual: where have you been? Where are you going? What do you think of the area? Carrie and I were confused by the entire conversation. We both felt that they were lying about who they were and where they said they had been. Some of the information they gave us seemed unusual, and we both had a bad feeling after talking with them. Barb and Zach said they were married, but by the way they spoke, it was as if they were making their story up as they went along. They told us they spent the day prior at the Grand Canyon, hiking to the bottom and back up in the same day. They explained how hot and tiring it was. And it didn't make sense. Barbara was as white as a sheet with no tan at all anywhere, not even on her hands. If she had spent the whole day hiking in the canyon, she would have color somewhere on her body. Even sunscreen would not have been enough to keep the sun off. Secondly, we were told that if you hike into the canyon, you have to camp on the floor because you wouldn't make it back up before it got dark. The hike took about 8 hours one way. Carrie and I knew that something wasn't right about these two people, but we weren't sure what it was. And at night we were both exhausted and decided to go to sleep early. Neither one of us had been sleeping well since our camping trip began. Every night I would wake up at least two, or even three, times. I looked forward to the early night so I could possibly catch up on my sleep. Waking early in the morning, I opened my eyes, and the moment I did, I knew something was wrong. I felt extreme anger, for what reason I wasn't sure. We crawled out of the tent and I told Carrie how I was feeling. I asked her to give me some time to myself so I could try to shake the awful feelings I was having. I couldn't remember ever feeling this way before. Not only was I angry, but I felt exhausted as well, despite the fact that I had not awakened in the night. I was as tired as if I had run a marathon. I was drained of every ounce of energy. Over the next 30 minutes we both got dressed and began to make breakfast without speaking. I then said, "I didn't wake up at all last night. I was completely out. So why do I feel like this? Maybe something happened last night." I began to look for cuts or marks on my arms, legs and stomach, anywhere I could see my own skin. "You know, Miriam, I didn't wake up last night either," said Carrie. It became clear that we had both had a strange night. I was beginning to think that maybe I had been taken by the aliens. Carrie and I looked over my body for any sign of being taken but found none. Zach then came over to say good morning to us. After some small talk he asked, "Did you hear the strange whizzing sounds last night?"
"No," I replied.
"What are you talking about?"
"Last night, I can't believe you didn't hear anything." He went on to describe a sound that was like a shrill zzzzz that went from campsite to campsite before staying around our campsite for a long time. It kept Barbara and I awake last night. We were so freaked out that we were going to go and find Stevenson to find out what was going on. Hearing this, I began to panic. The possibility of a visitation the night before seemed more real with his news. For the next half hour I walked around very upset by the events of the morning. I didn't want to talk with Barb and Zach anymore. The fact that they told me about the strange noises made me even more upset. Why did I not remember? Did aliens take me, and why? Was it my imagination? I left the questions unanswered for the time being in an attempt to keep my sanity. And at day Carrie and I were going to the Grand Canyon, passing through Hopi Land. I was excited about the layout of the day, but I still felt tired and sick. I tried to shake off the morning's events, but found it hard to do so. We were packing up our gear, preparing to leave, when Barbara and Zach came by one more time. They gave us a pass to enter into the Grand Canyon. It would save us $25 on the entrance fee, which was great. One stop they insisted we make was a place where they had had lunch. Zach repeated his directions once more and even wrote down the name of the place, Keams Canyon, so we wouldn't forget. We had one stop to make before we left, coffee with Stevenson. Carrie and I drove the car over to the coffee shack, where Stevenson was waiting, and he jumped up to say goodbye. We told him how much his private tour had meant to us both and how much we loved the canyon. Just then Barbara and Zach came by, again. They gave us a map of the Grand Canyon and told us about a good place to camp, insisting we use the site they indicated. By now Carrie and I were more suspicious of them than ever. We already knew we wouldn't camp where they had suggested, but thanked them anyway. When we looked over the map we found that the site they directed us to was the most remote site out of the hundreds that were there. Right after they left, Stevenson told us not to camp there. He too was very adamant. His normally quiet and soft-spoken nature was not present as he gave us this advice. Carrie and I felt that we should heed his warning. We left Canyon de Chelly that day with mixed emotions, sad to leave the canyon and happy to be on the road again. Within 10 minutes of leaving camp we saw a raven flying alongside our car. For the next few hours we saw it again and again in the distance, sitting on the side of the road. When we got close it would pick up and fly alongside our car until we passed. Both Carrie and I thought it might have been sent by Stevenson to keep us safe on our journey. It seemed to be with us all the way to the Grand Canyon. It was midday when Carrie and I pulled off at a sign that read, Keams Canyon, where there was a small store, McGee's Indian Art. Inside they had Hopi jewelry, masks, books and Kakina dolls. Kakinas are the spirits for which the Hopi hold ceremonies. Each spirit has a specific costume and the dolls are carved from wood to represent the different spirits. I was thrilled to be there. After careful consideration I decided to buy 2 books and an exceptional silver ring with the Hopi design. To my surprise the ring was not expensive at all and it had an authentic made by Hopi stamp on the inside. The woman who was working behind the counter was very friendly and helped me pick out the books she thought would interest me. As she began cleaning the ring with a cloth, I asked her what the symbols meant. She told me they represented man and water. She then squinted, deciphering the symbols, looked up at me, and then back at the ring. Andy's symbol is a sacred feather. This is a very special ring. She paused and looked again. Andy's is a very rare ring. It has a sacred feather on it. They normally don't make them with that symbol for the public. Andy's is very special. I was thrilled and knew that it was meant for me, understanding that it was another sign, showing me how, somehow, everything fit together in this quest. The ring had been waiting for me to come and pick it up. I felt as though I was stepping into a new life as I took the ring and placed it on my finger. The aliens had told me about my deep connection to the area. Somehow I knew I was connected to these people. The ring spoke to that feeling. Carrie went back out to the car when we had finished shopping, while I went to the store next door to grab a coffee. As I entered I saw a number of Hopi sitting in the restaurant. When I came out of the washroom I fixed myself the coffee, paid and turned to leave. I slowly walked out as I glanced around the entire room. 5 Hopi men were watching me. For a millisecond their heads appeared hyperextended on long necks, reaching out to me. They looked at me with wide eyes in which I saw spirals, just like I'd seen in Harold's eyes. Once again there was a flash before their appearance returned to normal. In that moment I knew who the Hopi people were. I understood why they had knowledge on UFOs and aliens. Many of my questions were answered. It was as though all the dots and lines suddenly fell into place. I understood more than ever before why I stood in Hopi land that day. By the time I got to the door to leave I knew that I would be back to see the Hopi people. My fate and the fates of many were tied to them. I knew that I had just been allowed to see the Hopi people for who they really were. It was clearer to me at that point than it had ever been that I was on a new path. I knew I was meant to have the special ring with the sacred feather on it. A new chapter began for my life. Everything I had been told in 1988 by the aliens was being confirmed for me on this journey. My work was about to begin. When I got back to the car I shared what I had just experienced with Carrie. I was shaking and calm at the same time. My path was now clear to me, yet I felt nervous because of the clarity. Furthermore, the recurring spirals baffled me. Carrie and I agreed that when we got home we would have to see if we could find any clues to the spirals' meaning. The search for the truth, as always, was ever expanding. I did know one thing however, the spirals were a message. The answer must be just around the corner, I thought. In the past day I have had a great deal of confirmation and clarity. When we entered the Grand Canyon and showed the woman our ticket Carrie noticed the date. It had been purchased the day after the couple from Canyon de Chelly said they hiked down to the canyon floor. In fact it was dated the same day they arrived in Canyon de Chelly. And as was proof to Carrie and I that we had been right about them, they had been lying about everything. The question was, why? After taking into account the strange night at the campsite, as well as their lies, we threw away every piece of paper they gave us. I didn't want any of their energy around. The whole encounter made me question why they encouraged us to stop at Keams Canyon in Hopi Land as they did. Our last campsite was at the Grand Canyon. We chose the site Stevenson told us about, at the top of the canyon near the entrance to the park. As we set up, a raven landed next to our tent. We saw this as a good sign that we were being watched over. Before the sun went down, we went to the lookout points. Both Carrie and I were disappointed in our experience at the Grand Canyon. The vastness certainly was a powerful vision to see in person. However, after spending time at Canyon de Chelly and feeling such a deep connection to the earth there, we felt there was no comparing the two. The sun was low on the horizon and the red rock appeared pale and washed out, making the view appear less dramatic as well. It was obvious we were viewing the sights at the wrong time of day to see it at its best. Unfortunately, we were now close to the end of our trip and this would be our only opportunity to see it. As we were getting ready to go to sleep that night, Carrie couldn't get her watch to work properly. It wouldn't let her set the alarm. We had to get up early to get back to Phoenix for our flight home, so we were a little concerned. I told Carrie not to worry, the raven would wake us up. It seemed to be watching over us and, if it truly was, it would help us in this matter. The sun of a new day came early to our campsite and, right on time, the raven sang to wake us at the exact time we requested. It was a wonderful way to end our time in the Four Corners area. We had a quick snack and quickly got on the road heading south, towards Phoenix and our flight home. We were both feeling sad that our time with the desert had to come to an end. Our experiences there filled our souls with a peace that is indescribable. The Four Corners area showed itself to us in many ways that we knew would remain in our hearts for a long time to come. On the surface, the earth there appears stark and almost dead. If you allow yourself to open up, it will jump up to your eyes, ears and all your senses and speak to you. The you can talk to the earth like nowhere else I have ever been. It is as if the earth can truly hear you and it then whispers back. We both understood why so many before us felt this part of the world was a power center. Carrie and I reflected on the intriguing set of events that had occurred during our journey. We looked forward to heading home, so we could have a hot shower and sleep in a bed. We spent the last leg of our trip with visions of Red Rock dancing in our heads. It was a journey for both of us that sparked new paths towards the fulfillment of our dreams. As the flight came to an end and we touched down in Vancouver, my thoughts turned back to the spirals. The moment I got in my apartment, I decided to see what information I could find on the internet that may explain their message. I looked for hours reading little pieces here and there, but didn't find anything that gave me insight into why I saw the spirals and how they pertained to me. I got frustrated and walked away from the computer, leaving it completely alone for a few days. When I returned to my quest, I was able to follow the trail of information straight to the Southwest Indians and the Hopi people. When I took a short break from my search, I called my friend Anna. I told her briefly about the incidents that had taken place on the trip. I told her about how I had met Harold and that the ATs had previously told me about him. "Oh my God," she said. "I remember you telling me about him years ago." She asked if I was sure it was Harold, so I gave her all the details of how we met. She was taken aback by the whole incident. Anna looked forward to finding out what the spirals meant, since she also thought they had to have significance. I hung up the phone and thought about how Anna had been there to support me from the very beginning of this experience. It meant a lot to me that she was still in my life after all I had been through. The sun shone in my little window in the kitchen as I sat at my computer. I had some spare time, so I decided to research the Hopi people and their culture. Maybe I would find something about what the spirals meant to them. As I skimmed the articles on different sites, I found myself straying from my focus to reading about the Hopi people. I came across the Hopi prophecies and began to read them. I knew I had found the answer to the spiral's mystery I was looking for. I read the words slowly, one by one, and began to cry. Why have I never seen this before? The Hopi prophecies were some of the things the aliens told me word for word. I couldn't believe it. I continued to read and found something they named the Blue Star Prophecy.